Madam Chairman,
ladies and gentlemen, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Everyone understands the literal meaning of these words in the great commandment which Moses gave unto his people. Moses was a great teacher. It is not so well known. He was a great yogi. Let us look very briefly into one other possible way of looking at this commandment. Honor thy father and thy mother. The father is God as creator. Mother is nature. God is the sun, energy. Mother is the earth, matter. The father is eternity. The mother is time. The father is prana. The mother is the womb of the world, akasha. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long. Days, consciousness, clear seeing of truth, enlightenment, may be long upon the land. This land is your own psychophysical organism, your own living being, which the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, in the original text, which signifies the absolute, the incomprehensible, unknown and unknowable deity, and Elohim, that absolute and unknown, as grasped by man in his supreme state of enlightenment, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, not has given, finished with once and for all, but gives you continuously from moment to moment in the present tense. And this is very significant indeed. This land, our individual being, starts off in the state of innocence and harmlessness, in harmony with the one total reality, Elohim. This innocence is the innocence of the child. It is an unawakened state, not knowing the conflict and sorrow and horror involved in the ambivalence of the dualistic world. But the shining of that golden age of unknowing innocence fades into twilight and even into darkness with the fall. The fall which comes inevitably with the passage of time and with the involvement in the conflict of good and evil, the first rude acquaintance with the actual nature of our dualistic world. Thereafter, he in whom the divine spark has not turned to cinder may emerge, if he really cares, into light, into the awakening which restores him to perfect communion with transcendence. Once again, he is innocent and harmless. But now, he is the full-fledged Son of Man, the Manasaputra, made wise through infinite sensitivity to all that suffers. He is the realized being, the Son of God, the Brahmaputra, the yogi who is the perfected Holy One. It is your divine destiny to be the living vehicle of transcendence if you really care. Howsoever that destiny is realized, that way of realization is yoga. To be the vehicle of transcendence, the heavenly man actually is this vehicle. I speak of the heavenly man of the Judeo-Christian tradition, known as Adam Kadmon by the Kabbalist. In the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus, he is the cosmic or ideal man brought forth by All-Father Mind as co-equal to himself. In the Vedas and Upanishads and Puranas, he is known as Purusha, or the person in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. He is known as Manu Svayambhuva, that is, the primordial man born of the self-existent. Is that heavenly man of the realm of transcendence the origin of all the forms of life here on earth, and also, through evolution, of earthly man? And did the fall take place in the sense that when the immeasurable through its self-limitation became matter, the finite and lowly forms of life and even man on earth could not possibly embody and represent divinity in full glory because of his ignorance and wayward desire and misspent passion and his hopeless lack of skill in action? If light comes upon you when you plunge into the deeps of religion, you will see in yoga the way of skill in action, which will take you yourself, the fallen one, to that summit of holiness where that heavenly man is no other than your own transformed total being. Each and every one of us is potentially the vehicle of transcendence. The form of this heavenly man is verily the form divine. Let us not restrict the meaning of the word form to its ordinary dictionary meaning. Here in our context, form is the pregnant void which holds within itself that plenitude of power and creative imagination by virtue of which all forms that can ever be known by us come into being. But remember that the void and the form divine is one only, the alone. the whole form of each earthly man. And there is hardly a man here or a man there who is awake to this whole form, is a miniature of the form divine, of the cosmos itself. Each man on earth is a microcosm which, in full fruition, is in harmony with the macrocosm. But we are as yet imperfect miniatures only of the heavenly man. Yoga, the whole yoga, perfects the miniature. The mind is the link between man and cosmos. We may almost say that the cosmos, as seen or experienced by us, comes to self-consciousness in man. We must never forget that man is integral part and parcel of the single whole cosmos. Unhappily, the mind in each one of us has not yet come to full fruition. It is still like a puling infant, sometimes ailing, sometimes diseased, and sometimes dangerous. One object of yoga is to heal the mind. In the healthy state, it is poised and silent, unconditioned, functioning intelligently with unerring insight. It may be helpful to regard the mind as the receptive, responsive sensitivity characterizing the living man. Because of this sensitivity, you receive impressions from the cosmos and respond to them. The inefficient functioning of this sensitivity is the mark of being out of step with life and disharmonious within oneself. When this sensitivity is fully developed, you are the vehicle of transcendence. That is, you are a person through whom the energy or power of transcendence works unobstructedly. This energy of transcendence may be understood by the student of yoga along lines such as the following, which present very briefly the basic philosophy and rationale of the practice of yoga. Ancient Indian tradition presents two fundamental properties of the universe. One, motion, and two, that in which it takes place, namely, space. Since our English words are not wholly adequate for our purposes, let us use a few Sanskrit words also. Akasha, or space, is that through which all things possess finite extension or body. That is, through which they make an appearance. In addition to space as we ordinarily sense it, Akasha is also mind space, or chittakasha, in which the discriminative activity of consciousness functions. And also, in the context of pure awareness, in which there is no subject-object duality, it is chid-akasha. What we call material things are the gross form of Akasha itself. Space concretized, so to say. In its subtle forms, it merges into forms of energy such as heat or light. This Akasha is measurable. It can be controlled and used by us. In contrast, Akasha, which is mind space, is non-finite, immeasurable. There is no specific here or there in it. Now the principle of motion is called prana, which is life energy, the rhythm of the universe. I'm using the word life in the old sense, not in the restricted biological sense only in which we use it nowadays, but life in its total sense. All the dynamic forces of the universe, objective, mental or spiritual, are modifications of prana. Breathing, so indispensable to the life of the body, is only one out of many functions through which prana, which is life in its most extensive meaning, manifests itself. Prana is more than breath, nervous energy, the creative power of seamen, the faculties of thought and intellect or of willpower, all of which are expressions of prana. The centers of psychocosmic force in the human body, called chakras, and their respective organs, correspond to the modifications of Akasha, and through these, prana flows and operates. Thus, we see that what is called pranayama in yoga is very much more than a technique of physical breathing. It is important to bear in mind that whilst it is convenient and even necessary to talk of prana and akasha separately, they cannot be separated in the supreme sense. They are one whole non-duality. Recall what was said earlier. Honor thy father and thy mother. Prana is father, Akasha is mother, and they are a non-duality because they are in timeless conjugation. The practical teaching of yoga is presented as the control and directing of psychocosmic forces, the pranas, through a structure of psychical centers, the chakras, and of psychical channels, the nadis. The chakras and nadis are associated spatially with different positions in the spine and with various nerves. They should not, however, be regarded as identical with physical organs, although there is some sort of actual relationship with them, since we know that mental activities, especially in meditation, do produce physical results. Let us now briefly consider the chakras. You will see that diagram there on the blackboard, for which I owe Many thanks to Mrs. Christine Singer for having drawn that diagram, as well as two diagrams which are on the back of that, which you will see later. We start at the base of the spine with what is the first chakra, the Mooladhara. That word means root support. It represents the element earth. In the Mundaka Upanishad, there is a sentence, earth is the footing of the Lord. And in Isaiah, as well as in the Acts of the Apostles, you find, heaven is my throne, and earth my footstool. Those who wrote such things were practical yogis who had realized for themselves, and they put their knowledge in the beautiful symbolic terms. Mooladhara contains the unqualified primordial vital energy which serves either the functions of physical reproduction and rejuvenation or transmutes these forces into spiritual potentialities. Now do remember that this energy spoken of is psychical energy. You must distinguish this from the actual physiological processes that take place in the body, which give the bodily sexual impulses. Don't get muddled up here. Otherwise, you will always find difficulty in understanding the meaning and significance of celibacy. This is the psychical counterpart of the physiological energy. The latent energy of this center is called Kundalini Shakti. Kundalini is the name of the goddess who they say presides over all power. The female aspect, the negative aspect of the whole universe, including man, is the active aspect, the aspect of power in operation. The male aspect has a different kind of dynamism altogether. It is a dynamism which functions in perfect stillness, which is a dynamic poise, not static. Now, the effects of Kundalini Shakti can be either divine or demoniacal. The impure one is destroyed by Kundalini Shakti. Only the one who is utterly pure in mind and heart to start with lives a pure life. He can utilize Kundalini Shakti, handle it with safety. Kundalini may be regarded as, or at least analogously to, what we call in modern times libido. It is said to sleep coiled up like a serpent at the base of the spine. Like a serpent. You know how Moses and Aaron and the priests of Pharaoh, his magicians, cast their rods and they turned into serpents. And those of Aaron and Moses ate up those of the priests, the magicians of Pharaoh. It might interest you in your spare moments to probe into that yourselves and see what you can discover. Unawakened, Kundalini is absorbed in subconscious and bodily functions. Released, it finds perfect unfoldment and realization, finally, in the chakra, which is the seventh, known as the Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus, which corresponds to the brain itself, the cerebrum. The second chakra is Svadhisthana, which is situated at the genitals, in the genital region. And Svadhisthana is so called because it means own abode. And it is called own abode because, as far as the living body as body is concerned, and our sense of separate selfhood is concerned, it is the source of the most intense sense of I-ness. The male and the female genital organs embody the strongest sense of I-ness in us. Svadhisthana represents the element water. In Buddhist yoga, we have a slight difference. Buddhist yoga tends to group Mooladhara and Svadhisthana together as a single root center, as a sacral plexus, not a separate pelvic and hypogastric plexus. The third one is called Manipura, which means lustrous as a gem. Pura also means fortress, the jeweled fortress. This chakra represents fire. It is concerned with the forces of physical and psychical transformation. All the processes of digestion and so on, the commerce of the living process that takes place inside here. And it is usually associated with the navel. Sometimes it's called the Nabi Padma, the navel lotus. And there is a very profound significance to the navel, because the umbilical cord connects the infant before its birth from the navel to the mother. And through the navel, every one of us in the world is connected right up to our remotest ancestry. The next one is called Anahata. Now here we come to something extremely interesting and significant. Anahata means the place where the munis hear the sound which comes without striking two things together. The muni is the Holy One who is the Silent One. This does not mean that he never talks or utters any words. He speaks only when necessary, and only what is necessary. That is merely the physical aspect. Any one of us could, with a little practice, be part Munis. But there is the profounder aspect. This silence is the silence of the mind. It means the end of that incessant chatter that goes on in the brain despite ourselves, day and night. During the talks last April, I tried to explain a little bit about the tremendous significance of this. So the Muni is the silent one in that sense, far more than in the physical sense. And Anahata is the chakra, the place where Munis hear the sound which comes without striking two things together. One hears the sound of the pulse of life, of prana. Whilst one is the embryo only, perhaps the first thing one becomes aware of inside the mother's body is the sound of the beating of the mother's heart and that peculiar roaring sound which you hear if you dive into water, as you hear when you dive into water, the sound of the circulation of the mother's blood. That is on the physical level. But there is another sound, the pulse of life itself. Indescribable. You must experience it for yourself. And it has no relationship, remember, to physical sound, as we know it, as investigated by science. And physical sound reaches us through physical media, the air, any gaseous medium, any liquid medium, any solid medium. Sound does not travel through a vacuum. But strangely enough, this sound is the sound whose medium, whose source, they declare, is akasha as ether. Not akasha as solid, liquid, or gas. I'm using the word which we used up to the end of the last century, purely for convenience. There is no English word equivalent to it. So I have to use a word which is now disused in modern science, ether. See? So, one uses the word hear, but obviously one doesn't hear with the physical ears in the usual physical way. This is another kind of hearing. Anahata represents air. But I often wonder whether they meant air in the sense in which we use the word air today, the gaseous state as we know it scientifically. Or did it include what we used to call ether? I myself suspect it included that. Like the heart, anahata is concerned with respiration, and it is situated on the vertical central axis of the body. The next chakra is called the Vishuddhi chakra. And Vishuddhi means made pure. It is concerned with speech. It's called the throat center sometimes. It is concerned with speech and with mantric sound. That is, the use of the voice to produce deep psychical effects. It is concerned with speech, but do not understand speech here in the ordinary sense, as for instance, speech in the sense in I am talking to you now, and that is speech. True, that is speech. But the speech with which they were concerned, as far as the Vishuddhi chakra was concerned, was prophetic speech. He who could take Kundalini shit safely up to the Vishuddhi chakra was very much in tune now with the realm of transcendence. And whatsoever he said, or any gesture he made, which somehow inspired the listener or the onlooker to get a sense of transcendence thereby, that was prophetic speech. So you see, the Vishuddhi chakra, as far as its mantric effect is concerned, must be regarded as the source of the word of power. And it represents very definitely akasha as ether. Next we come to the Ajneya chakra, associated with the medulla, so called because the command of the teacher is received from above. That is the symbolic language in which it is put. Or, I would prefer to put it this way, is heard from within. Because you yourself are both disciple and teacher, learner and master. What you receive from someone else stimulates you. And if the stimulation is of the right sort, then that which enlightens you is within yourself. And if you are quiet and alert and sensitive, you learn. And you learn the deep things that are beyond words and beyond concepts and all the limitations of discursive thinking. So this is what Ajneya deals with. It represents insight into the truth which is transcendence. Finally, the Sahasrara, the crown center, or the thousand-petaled lotus as it is called. It represents the infinite variety and sum total of all that is represented by all the six chakras already mentioned. It is regarded as sometimes belonging to a higher order altogether. It is as if a new octave of being and consciousness begins with Sahasrara. It is the abode of Shiva, Sadashiva. Shiva, as you know, is the name of the third person of the Trinity, the Hindu Trinity. And Shiva means the auspicious one. Sadashiva means the ever auspicious one. It is the abode of the supreme deity within your own being. The transition from Ajna to Sahasrara represents the liberation out of all separate selfhood into transcendence. One is no longer in charge of oneself. That means the separate self-consciousness is no longer in charge of one's total being, because transcendence itself has taken over. In Christian terminology, the manhood is taken up into the Godhead. This is the transition from the Ajna to the Sahasrara. Since Ajna and Sahasrara are so close to each other, they are sometimes, as in Buddhist yoga, regarded as a single crown center. The word chakra means a wheel. The crown and throat centers are the front wheels, and the heart and navel centers are the rear wheels of the fiery chariot of the spirit in its ascent to transcendence. Think of Elijah being taken up to heaven in the fiery chariot. Now, a few words about the nadis, the channels. Prana reveals itself in the form of two dynamic tendencies. The polar currents of force which flow through the body are solar energies, and the vehicle is Pingala Nadi, which is on the right side of the vertebral column. These represent the forces of the day. Remember, not day in the purely physical sense of the term, but in the sense in which I suggested at the beginning of this talk. That is, centrifugal forces which tend towards conscious awareness, objective knowledge, differentiation, intellectual discrimination. Those are the solar energies. And there are the lunar energies, of which the vehicle is the Ida Nadi, which is on the left of the vertebral column. These symbolize the forces of the night working in the darkness of the subconscious mind. They are the undifferentiated, regenerative, centripetal forces flowing from the all-encompassing source of life and tending towards reunification, for example, in the impulses of love, of all that had been separated by the intellect. The most important channel is the Sushumna Nadi, which runs like a hollow channel through the center of the spinal column, meeting Ida and Pingala in the perineum at the base of the spine. The Sushumna is not only able to cause a synthesis between the solar and lunar currents, which are forms of prana, but also of the seven centers vertically upwards from the base of the spine to the brain. This integration is experienced successively through the chakras. The Sushumna is a symbol of all potentialities lying dormant in every human being and which are realized by the yogi. One such potentiality is the faculty of becoming directly conscious of the inner relationship between ideas, things, facts, sense data, and forces. Now you see, your chairman sits in one of the postures which we learn and practice in yoga. The postures are called asanas. And the point I want to emphasize is this, that in this posture, Mooladhara is in touch with earth. The old yogis, of course, used to sit out in the open on the earth. So we have the contact of earth to earth, because Mooladhara represents earth. It is the root. Earth to earth. The micro touches the macrocosm. Similarly, earth in relation to space is the microcosm related to the macrocosm. So all the psychic energies which emanate out of what we in the ordinary way call matter, and the psychic energies which are concerned with man, the living person, are in right relationship, earth to earth. Now the spinal column is called the Meru Danda. Danda means a stick, or in this case it happens to be a living stick, the vertebral column. And it's called the Meru Danda. Mount Meru is the mystical, sacred mount where the ultimate realization takes place. And it is this danda which leads right up to the top, which is Mount Meru, the Mount Meru of the individual, which is the point at which transcendence itself makes contact with you, the living person. So now, the Meru Danda is upright, as if it were like a lightning conductor. And Sahasrara, the topmost chakra, points to the celestial zenith. So, earth to earth, and just as the earth is related to the celestial zenith, so is the individual yogi related through Sahasrara to the celestial zenith. The energy, prana, of matter radiates out macroscopically from earth to cosmos, and in the person up microscopically from Mooladhara to Sahasrara. The energy of transcendence responds through Sahasrara down to Mooladhara, sensitizing, refining, and transforming you. That is why, if you do sit properly, at ease, elastic, still and silent, you experience all the extraordinary benefit that comes out of such practice. But never forget the indispensable preliminary of the purity of the mind and the heart and of daily life. When this is accomplished, the finite you is fully subsumed in the infinite. The divorce between man and God is out. Once again, there is the primordial unity. Benediction floods your being and spreads through you all over the earth. Merudanda, whilst you are still caught fast in worldliness, was the tree of good and evil. Merudanda, after the complete reversal of worldliness, and consequently living in the state of holiness, is the tree of life. We must consider just a few points more, and I hope I'm not taxing your patience too much. We must deal with, very briefly, with the transformation of consciousness, which is the fundamental objective of the yogi. When Kundalini Shakti, the latent energy lying dormant at the root center, is awakened in the purified one by means of meditation and physical techniques which are kept secret, Shakti, that is power, is led upwards from Muladhara to Sahasrara, the crown center, step by step through all the chakras. Each of these stages marks a transformation of consciousness. As you go upwards and emerge into a profounder state of consciousness, the old is not destroyed or annihilated, but all its essence is taken up into the new state. There is no annihilation whatsoever. The ascent spans the entire range from worldly consciousness to transcendence itself. Now, Muladhara to Manipura, the navel center, deals with the worldly life. As we have already seen, our daily life is concerned fundamentally, primarily because of our animal descent, as far as the body is concerned, is primarily concerned with the preservation of oneself and the preservation of the species. That means all that is bound up with food and drink and sex. So these three centers belong to this world, so to say, and to all that is involved with this world of everyday physical living. Muladhara, Svadhisthana, Manipura. Then we come to Anahata, the heart center, where true egohood is realized. True egohood, which is devoid of egoism. True egohood means that one is rightly self-conscious, self-responsibly self-conscious, free of the tyranny of desire. Such true egohood contains within itself the energy for its own transcending. Now the transcending will take place very consciously and only from within yourself. Nature cannot go any further without our deliberate cooperation. We have the power to say yea, we have the power to say nay. You must care. And if you really care, man comes to fulfillment and fruition through each and every one of you. Otherwise, there is no such thing as fruition or fulfillment for any man. So now, In anahata, there takes place the pacification of sense consciousnesses. And in anahata, one enters the first deep state of meditation. Real meditation begins there. And here, as I said, the pacification of the sense consciousnesses takes place. If you examine the process that goes on in your mind throughout the day, you will find that all the sense impressions and sense images keep rising up all the time. After they have sunk into the subconscious, they keep rising up and clamor for attention. We may have our drawing rooms spick and span and like a shop window for tidiness and order and whatnot. But look at what happens inside one's own brain. It's a wonderful wilderness, a jungle, a confusion. Complete confusion. The labyrinth through which you have to find your way and arrive safely at the other end. Watch it. Follow it. Don't fight against it. Don't give way to it. Don't indulge it. But don't indulge it, and at the same time, don't fight it. That is your task, a tricky one, a difficult one. But when you do it, the clamor of the sense consciousnesses will subside. And for the first time, you will know the meaning of peace, which is not the mere opposite of turmoil and strain, but that which transcends the conflict of the dualities of quiet and turmoil. The next is the Vishuddhi Chakra. Here one goes quite beyond the word, which means beyond finitude and mortality. I won't say anything about it tonight because I spoke quite a lot about this last April. Here is the realm of prophetic speech. It is the second deep stage of meditation where all discursive thinking as such comes to an end. Thoughts will rise up still. They will flow along, but all self-association with those thoughts has ceased, and the origination of those thoughts out of one's own self through one's own desire and frustrations and unfulfillments and so on, all that has ceased. This is the great significance of the Vishuddhi Chakra as such. Here the unified mind, unified, made one, whole, for the first time, functions at its own level and in its own rights. The receptive, responsive sensitivity that I spoke of earlier is at its peak, and there is release from isolative self-consciousness. At the Ajneya Chakra, concerned with the medulla, one goes beyond all ideation. There is direct perception of the great archetypes. And in Sahasrara, there is complete pacification of all sense consciousnesses, freedom from isolative self-consciousness, and self-obtrusion upon the totality. We as we are obtrude upon the world. But that obtrusiveness completely ceases. Then there is no conflict between self and not self, between being and non-being. In fact, all those barriers are out, and you realize the wholeness of existence. There is no such thing in that state which one may call my mind, because one has become empty, transparent. And so, that mind which is commonly spoken of as the divine mind or the cosmic mind functions freely through you. In this state, power can be handled safely. Otherwise, in the ordinary worldly state, we always mishandle power. For now, love and wisdom are in perfect harmony. So, in the ascent from Muladhara, Kundalini Shakti works in and through finitude, constraint, and mortality, and ascends right up to Shiva, the abode of Shiva, peaceful, auspicious, non-moving, universally active, infinite, immeasurable. And there Shakti enjoys bliss with her Lord, the bliss of union with Shiva. Father and mother are one. It is in this state that one realizes, I believe, the meaning of the words of Jesus after he had ascended, "All power is given unto me in heaven and earth." The united Shiva Shakti returns to Muladhara, as they say in the books. But I say, it not only returns to Muladhara, the united Shiva Shakti rise up again and make their final abode during the lifetime of the yogi at Anahata, because it is at this level that one is in tune with all mankind. What happens? The united Shiva Shakti, coming right down to Muladhara, completely purify, refine and sensitize the whole being so that every vestige of impurity is out. You are the perfected Holy One. But if you just remain there, you are isolated.
But when the united Shiva Shakti ascends again to Anahata, it transcendentalizes all the worldly functions represented by Muladhara, Svadhisthana, and Manipura, and the work which falls to our lot in ordinary everyday life. This, as far as I'm aware,
is not stated
in the books.
But that is what happens. Shiva Shakti resides there in the perfected Holy One. And at the time of death, rises right up to Sahasrara again, and the end of the body takes place. So, from Muladhara to Sahasrara is from earth to heaven. The Maitreya and the Skanda Upanishads say, the body of the purified one, of course, is the temple of the Lord. The dweller in that temple is Shiva himself. Once again, the words of Isaiah, and I'll give you the full quotation this time. The heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What manner of house will ye build unto me? And what place shall be my rest?